paper 4, section 2, which is old single column, page 56. Okay, so remember what we're up to here. In the back in paper 2, they stepped through the nature of God. And ever since then, they've been working on, okay, so this is, that's the nature of God. Now, what does that imply? They've been working on what deductively, you know, rationally follows from the facts of that nature. Like the attributes of God. And now, besides, you know, directly the attributes, we're, you know, we're looking at also what follows not just in and of God himself, but God's relationship to the universe and to others. So if you look at the title of this section, God and Nature. Okay, yeah, so we had the nature of God. So yes, God has a nature, but nature is not God. That's what we're, you know, they're going to address now. That simple deductive step from God has a nature, but nature is not God. So let's see where they go with it. Go ahead, Andre.
God and nature. Nature is, in a limited sense, the physical habit of God. The conduct or action of God is qualified and provisionally modified by the experimental plans and the evolutionary patterns of a local universe, a constellation, a system, or a planet. God acts in accordance with a well-defined, unchanging, immutable law throughout the wide-spreading master universe. But he modifies the patterns of his action so as to contribute to the coordinate and balanced conduct of each universe, constellation, system, planet, and personality in accordance with the local objects, aims, and plans of the finite projects of evolutionary unfolding. Therefore, nature, as mortal man understands it, presents the underlying foundation and fundamental background of a changeless deity and his immutable laws, modified by, fluctuating because of, and experiencing upheavals through the working of the local plans, purposes, patterns, and conditions which have been inaugurated and are being carried out by the local universe, constellation, system, and planetary forces and personalities. For example, as God's laws have been ordained in Nebadon, they are modified by the plans established by the Creator Son and Creative Spirit of this local universe. And in addition to all this, the operation of these laws has been further influenced by the errors, defaults, and insurrections of certain beings resident upon your planet and belonging to your immediate planetary system of Satania.
Okay, now just one little basic thing to note there. I mean, the details are all pretty upfront, pretty straightforward. But did you notice a flavor there that was kind of different than the way he's constructed paragraphs here recently? It's very, very minutia-oriented and repetitive. And I mean, he's clearly trying, it's like, okay, set your soaring spiritual consciousness aside for a moment, you know, and let me challenge you to be very detail-oriented and to put everything in, you know, look at how he repeated the whole sequence of universe, constellation. It's like, I was like, wow, you just said that. Did you really need to, couldn't you have used some generalization? But he really is, is clearly trying to pull you out of any sort of a distinct unity mode, and activate your ability to recognize all the little parts and put them all in their places. He wants that eye fully open before he goes on. And he knows there's a large paragraph break after those first two. So he has kind of appreciate, there's always something going on between the lines like that, and be alert enough to recognize that, or ask yourself if it isn't immediately obvious. Now, he probably has a number of things he wants me to be syncing up with. What are they? There's details, there's big picture. Okay, so there it's just very obvious. Like, it's like, whoa, that's just like very plodding. But that's the point. He wants you to get into that mode where you're going step by step in your thinking, and there's like, oh, I have to consider that and that, and what if that, and all that sort of detail. Okay, and then?
Nature is a time-space resultant of two cosmic factors. First, the immutability, perfection, and rectitude of paradise deity. And second, the experimental plans, executive blunders, insurrectionary errors, incompleteness of development, and imperfection of wisdom of the extra paradise creatures from the highest to the lowest. Nature therefore carries a uniform, unchanging, majestic, and marvelous thread of perfection from the circle of eternity. But in each universe, on each planet, and in each individual life, this nature is modified, qualified, and perchance marred by the acts, the mistakes, and the disloyalties of the creatures of the evolutionary systems and universes. And therefore must nature ever be of a changing mood, whimsical withal, though stable underneath, and varied in accordance with the operating procedures of a local universe.
Okay, so now he took what he introduced there in this first two, and he fleshed it out a little bit. You see what he, what the main point he's wanting to bring out is to recognize that the Father is relating to that foundation underneath, and he expressed it that way and a few other ways of, that there is a continuity that he can relate to, and it's important to remember that the Father, as opposed to the Mother, is the individuality of the parts. The Mother is the individuality of the whole. So when they're speaking about this, when you're thinking about this Father's relationship to, he said like those stable underneath, and those sorts of expressions of this continuity threaded through it all. They're pointing out that just because he for instance, gives each of us an absolutely unique personality. And in terms of between any two of us, that makes us absolutely separate from one another and absolutely dependent upon the Mother to link us together. For the Father, that doesn't separate the two of us from the Father. There's a commonality amongst all within the Father, for no other reason. That's where this came from. So obviously he must possess something that transcends all of that absolute uniqueness and then subsequently to bestow, have a relationship to some continuity that's threaded through all this individuality, something very subtle and deep. Okay, so there, So that's, one of the really main points that he just wants to, it's like, okay, yeah, you have this, this notion of, of relationship to God, to nature. Like you said at the beginning, nature is in a limited sense the physical habit of God. It's in this sense, in that, it's his habit of God the Father is in that very subtle thread through all the individuality. Okay, and it's really just, that's not so much for our benefit, but for His, in the sense of to be the first source and center of all things and beings, you somehow have to have a common connection to all things and beings. But I don't participate in that. My relationship to the Father is absolutely separate from, you know, any other relationship to the Father. Yeah.
Was any of the physical evolution of the planet upset by the Lucifer rebellion?
That's extremely hard to answer. We don't know how that all plays together. I mean, there is a relationship between physical evolution and biological evolution, and between physical control and or maybe over control. You should say physical over control and biologic over control. Now, and those have to be synchronized in subtle ways. The master physical controllers don't act, independent of the life carriers. They're working very closely with the life carriers. So, you know, when the life evolution went certain ways, or when vicissitudes cropped up that affected that, you could very well speculate that there may have been some modifications to how they've manipulated the planet subsequently. It's hard to know with any precision.
None of the life carriers went into rebellion.
No. But the life carriers' plans were all upset, you know, and the plans involved the master physical controllers. The plans of the life carriers were upset by the rebellion and the default, and the life carriers' plans involve the master physical controllers. So, see, there's definitely a possibility that the master physical controllers might have had to gone to, you know, if such and so, then, you know, there may have been an if clause, you know, in their part of the plans that got, you know, activated. It's hard to know.
I know that the part where the diseases and bacteria and stuff, they said that they saw that, but they thought, well, Adam and Eve compensate for that.
Right.
And then it didn't happen, so that would have an effect. But on nature itself, with the hurricanes and this and that, I don't.
Yeah, well, not those sorts of things. We're talking more things about their control of the earth that current science is completely ignorant of. Things, you know, that are extremely subtle that we don't understand. All of this, there's some linkage between the Earth and the sub-electronic level energies in the cosmos. You know, science knows nothing of such things. You know, and what it needs to be, or how it needs to be changed. I mean, who knows? See, so I mean, those sorts of unknown things are what we're, you know, are potentially in play here. Okay, but when you brought that up, just notice that sequence. Okay, so marred by the acts, mistakes, and disloyalties. If they're invoking a series, do you notice that it's a crescendoing series in the negative sense? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Error, evil, sin. Yeah. Now, if it's just, you know, unwise acts, okay, error. You know, when it goes to mistakes, now we're talking evil, you know, and disloyalties, of course, that's sin. It's just, you know, just notice when they invoke that sequence. They often do it in proxy like this, you know, by using another sequence that parallels error, evil, sin. You have to kind of delight at his little poetic flourish there, to use whimsical withal, and to kind of anthropomorphize it with a changing mood, you know. But one of the things that's in play here, you know, the whole difficulty of sorting God apart from nature humans have long struggled with that whole animism sort of approach to nature, where you have basically a pantheistic sort of deity notion where he's woven into every rock and whatnot, in a very direct, literal way, and it's all so spirit and matter are all confused together, and he's just pointing out the fact that it's so complicated, what rides upon that immutable foundation. It's so complicated that it's not difficult to anthropomorphize it. And that's the point of using that language. We shouldn't be too hard on ourselves or our ancestors for thinking like this, because it's not that bizarre of a thing to anthropomorphize all that if you don't know any better.
There almost seems to be a deliberate resonance with that, in order to engage us where we are and say, but here's what underlies all of that.
Right. And and obviously you're setting up God is love, but love is not God, a similar sort of, like I said, God has a nature, but nature is not God. You often are invoking a logical, objective recognition where, subjectively you might have had a tendency to think it was, an if and only if sort of a situation. But it's just one direction. It's not both directions. And only by invoking your objective perspective and, does that become clear? And so they're always fostering that. Step back and just, what do you see? It doesn't go both directions, does it? I mean, it should be obvious to you if you just step back that nature is not God.
Nature is the perfection of paradise, divided by the incompletion, evil, and sin of the unfinished universes. This quotient is thus expressive of both the perfect and the partial, of both the eternal and the temporal. Continuing evolution modifies nature by augmenting the content of paradise perfection and by diminishing the content of the evil, error, and disharmony of relative reality.
Okay, so just, just take one moment and reflect on that little simple mathematical equation that they couched this in. So we have just this simple quotient. And the numerator, and at the start of everything, we have this unit of absolute perfection of paradise. So in the numerator is one. It's a unit of absolute perfection of paradise. And when you the moment that you start, there's no evil and sin yet, so those are zero. And what do you have in the denominator? You have one unit of absolute incompleteness. It's absolutely incomplete. So you start out, it's one divided by one. Nature is one. And that's very purposely, there's many things that's trying to get you to turn around and think about unity as the starting point rather than zero. So in the beginning was unity. And then God sets the ball rolling. That unit of absolute perfection of paradise stays constant. Nothing changes in the numerator. But the denominator, after some extended period of actualization, you don't have a full unit of absolute incompleteness. Maybe you have 0.7. It's 0.7 absolutely incomplete. And let's say of that part that's that's no longer absolutely incomplete, let's it's it's probably not absolutely complete. Some of it might be, but you know, some of it's just going to be relatively complete. It hasn't gotten all the way to eternity yet, and so because it's just relatively complete, there may be some evil and sin in there that would add to the denominator. You know, you could say, well, let's imagine that all adds up to say, you know, 0.05. So we have 0.7 plus 0.05, so it's like 0.75 in the denominator. You know, 3/4 in the denominator. So now the quotient is 4/3. It's 1.33. So we've gone from 1 to 1.33. And on it goes, you know, until eventually you take it all the way into eternity. And you have what's the measure of absolute incompleteness? Zero. And what's the measure of evil and sin? Zero. The denominator, you know, you take it all the way into eternity. The denominator is zero. The quotient's gone to infinity. That's the infinity of the cosmos infinite. So starts with unity and ends with the infinity of the cosmos infinite. And it does it, you know, like there's, you know, to appreciate how that happens. Like they're saying it, you're augmenting the content of paradise perfection. You're taking that one unit of absolute paradise perfection and you're copying it into infinity. Remember, it's a pattern and patterns are copied. Remember those statements about paradise? So you're copying it into infinity. And so now the cosmos infinite, you know, nature is infinity. Okay, so that's what they're invoking, just a simple way of kind of appreciating how that works. All right, so there's, he started pretty detailed, factual oriented, and he's still definitely in that mode. He even invoked a simple mathematical relationship to understand. Okay, so now what? Now that he's really laid that out in front, what does he do next?
God is not personally present in nature or in any of the forces of nature, for the phenomenon of nature is the superimposition of the perfections of progressive...
Imperfection.
Did I say perfections? Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. The phenomenon of nature is the superimposition of the imperfections of progressive evolution and sometimes the consequences of insurrectionary rebellion upon the paradise foundations of God's universal law. As it appears on such a world as Urantia, nature can never be the adequate expression, the true representation, the faithful portrayal of an all-wise and infinite God. Nature on your world is a qualification of the laws of perfection by the evolutionary plans of the local universe. What a travesty to worship nature because it is, in a limited, qualified sense, pervaded by God, because it is a phase of the universal and therefore divine power. Nature also is a manifestation of the unfinished, the incomplete, the imperfect outworkings of the development, growth, and progress of a universe experiment in cosmic evolution.
Okay, now on the one hand, he seems to be kind of reiterating, but notice what he threw in there, an exclamation point sentence. Okay, so he's not done with us. You know, remember how what mode he was in at the end of the previous paper. And it said, it is a great blunder to humanize God. And then he said, but even that is not so stupid as completely to mechanize the idea of the first great source and center. Now, he dropped a once word in the first three parts of the book, you know, stupid. So that whole notion of taking the first source and center and conceiving of the first source and center as the great machine stupid as a fence post, he says. Okay, and he doesn't mince any words here either. Again, travesty is not a faint word. Okay, what a travesty. In other words, how ridiculous, how grotesquely absurd. I mean, that's the substance of the word travesty. Grotesquely absurd. Now, that's why there's an exclamation point at the end of that. So, you know, it's rather interesting. I mean, notice how much passion he has behind the notion of a mechanistic first source and center, or thinking that nature is God. And we're going, well, yeah, okay, so, you know, whatever. It's not a whatever, yeah. It's huge. I mean, he thinks it's just the dumbest thing he's ever seen. Okay, I mean, you know, just beyond the pale, stupid. When he observes this, so I mean, it's just interesting to note this and to try to figure out. It's like, wow, where do I have to be to have such passion behind that? Because I don't think I'm there. If I want to be where the author of this paper is, where this divine counselor is, to see things the way he sees it, I have to get to a place where I have a similar reaction to those thoughts. And that should strike you as just kind of odd. how can I get to the point where I just can't think of any other way to express myself except to put a great big exclamation point, you know, after this sentence. Just to note that it's another one of these things where, you know, you could kind of just blow through that, but never do. Notice these little things. There's a subtext in the mind of the divine counselor here that is not easy to appreciate. And so it's a real challenge that he's putting in front of you to understand where he's coming from, why this is apparently has such potential, you know, catastrophic consequences that he would be so impassioned about it.
Yeah. What group, when this book was indicted, what group was worshiping nature that he would have been directing that at?
I'm not going to answer that because we're going to get to that in the first paragraph of the next section. And we'll see what group that is. Remember, it's never, again, like I said, I mean, if he's impassioned about this, it can't be some simplistic thing we're talking about. It can't be mere primitiveness that we're talking about here. We're talking about sophistry. We're talking about seeds of calamity. Remember how I've pointed out, you know, one section always is the pretext for the next section, you know, let them build.
The apparent defects of the natural world are not indicative of any such corresponding defects in the character of God. Rather, are such observed imperfections merely the inevitable stop moments in the exhibition of the ever-moving reel of infinity picturization? It is these very defect interruptions of perfection continuity which make it possible for the finite mind of material man to catch a fleeting glimpse of divine reality in time and space. The material manifestations of divinity appear defective to the evolutionary mind of man only because mortal man persists in viewing the phenomenon of nature through natural eyes, human vision unaided by Marantia Moda or by revelation, its compensatory substitute on the worlds of time.
Okay, now that last little bit first. Notice how the human vision and eyes, you know, they're okay. Viewpoint. You know, we've challenged ourselves to begin to have multiple viewpoints in our consciousness quite a bit for the last several months. What's the main thing that they're contrasting there? You know, if you insist upon trying to understand everything purely from an individuality viewpoint. You know, this is just not going to come together for you. And since you don't have Maharaja Moda to begin to have an internalized, immediate unity viewpoint, you need to recognize the unity viewpoint and the revelation and take it on. You need to stop kidding yourself that you have a unity viewpoint just because you're a very fervently spiritual individuality viewpoint fact. Okay? That's not unity viewpoint, being all passionate as a point particle. Okay? That's not the unity viewpoint. And so that... right. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's what's being invoked there. But notice the fun analogy that he's drawing. Okay, so you know, you don't have to literally think of, you know, 35 millimeter film here. I mean, just any video with frames per second. Okay, what is he saying there? Just imagine if you were watching a video and the frame rate was infinite frames per second. Would you be able to have a relationship to that if that video was playing at infinite frames per second? No.
Not unless I had that bandwidth.
No. There has to be, you know, it has to have a finite number of frames per second in order for you to have any relationship to it. Those stop moments, you engage that frame and then that frame and then the differential between the two frames and then the next frame and, you know, and et cetera. That's how you're getting, can build up some sense of what eternity is like.
And yet, in all of this, it's definitely not saying that you can't appreciate nature and the beauty of nature. It's only worshiping nature, which is so ridiculous.
Yeah. And substituting nature for God, which is obviously not going to be difficult to do if you stumble upon nature that's very beautiful. And what's one of the aspects of God that we all know about? Beautiful. God is beautiful. Nature is beautiful. Well, therefore, nature must be God. No. No. Yeah. I mean, humans have stumbled into that forever. Humans still stumbling. I mean, it takes just a split second, and that, you know, and you don't have to be, you know, somehow, you know, in a very scholarly fashion, you know, writing a treatise on this, you know, it's just, is it subtly playing in your mind that you've blurred that line?
Like when you see a sunset or a sunrise.
Nature to me is, you know, when you're in nature that's quiet, you can hear the still small voice of God.
Now just notice one thing. What I'm saying is has a measure of controversy, doesn't it? Your spiritual consciousness is feeling a little bit challenged. I've got to raise my hand. I've got to say something because I'm feeling like Chris is like no. Not appreciating. See, but no, just notice that. Notice your spiritual consciousness very strongly, you know, is drawn to truth, beauty, and goodness. But you have to be the master of that. You can't let it have the final word. You have to say to it, yes, that is beautiful, that is true, that is good, but that is not God.
If you get away in the quietness of nature, you give yourself the opportunity to very distinctly hear another voice, but it doesn't have anything to do with the tree and God are the same.
Right, but what's... Right, but what's the difference? I mean, you have a strong personal God notion in your consciousness. Many don't. Don't assume that just because it's clear to you, it's clear to everyone on the planet, and so that's not an issue. You know, it may be not an issue to you at all, but it may be one of the most problematic issues on the planet, because it's sad to record. You know, so few persons can distinguish. You know, maybe just one little point to emphasize again in the same context, along we brought up, you know, not just beauty, but truth and goodness. God is good, but goodness is not God. And an exhibition of creature willingness to share the inner life with goodness is not the same as an exhibition of creature willingness to share the inner life with personalized, all-knowing deity. Right there, knowing every single thing in your consciousness. Do you exhibit, you know, that? There's many people who exhibit a willingness to share the inner life with goodness, but God? I don't think so. That's way too scary. Let's just pretend that goodness is enough. Yeah. No, you want the harsh challenge of bringing personalized deity into your inner life, an all-searching eye. Do you have the courage to do that? You know? Doing the will of God is nothing more or less than an exhibition of creature willingness to share the inner life with that. That's doing the will of God. Scary stuff.
Complete openness.
Right.
Doesn't Psalms have something like search my inner parts or something?
Sure,
like that?
Sure, of course. I mean, this is not some, you know, amazingly new thought. It's just gotten a little fuzzy. The revelators are here. It's like, remember those thoughts you know, your way ancients had? You need to bring those back to the forefront because you've gotten really fuzzy on it. You know, there's a difference between spiritual experience and personal spiritual experience. You know, religion comes into play when you're sharing the inner life with God. Spiritual experiences could be nothing but sharing the inner life with goodness. There's no God involved. There's no survival, of value of that. You know, it may have value in the Almighty, but not in your soul. Sharing the inner life with goodness only augments the Almighty. It doesn't augment your soul. That's where the truth of, you know, the drop of water in the ocean comes from. If your whole notion of what you can, the most that you can do is share inner life with goodness, then you're right. All of that is a drop of water in the ocean when you die. You know, it doesn't, you didn't use your gift from the Father to grasp that yourself. You didn't make it personal. You just let it be merely spiritual.
But also when the volcanoes are erupting and your house is burning down and
exactly.
Your neighbors are getting killed and shots are being fired across the whatever.
And all that sharing your life with goodness goes poof.
Goes poof. And if you've got your rock,
Sharing the inner life with God builds that mere faith into trust. It builds spiritual faith into soul trust. It builds it into literal spiritual fibers in your being that hold you together when things get tough. You know, all of the sharing of the inner life with goodness in the world is for naught when times get tough, because that doesn't produce any fibers within you. You're no stronger internally because of it. You just felt good while it was happening.
You're letting it pass through.
Right, it's just flowing through you. You know, it's not taking up residence in your soul. And so you cannot fall back on it when you need it. It's not there. It flowed through. You know?
Chris, I know it says somewhere in your ancient book that Jesus did say, he did say go about doing good, but he also mm-hmm. said to go and do righteousness. And so...
And before you go about doing good, what do? Seek first... Yeah, the kingdom of God, not the kingdom of goodness. Seek first the kingdom of God, then go about doing good. It's just the order is all important. You have to take up the full challenge. Just that fun little thing of... you could spend some time with that paragraph reflecting on the whole stop moment analogy and stuff, and how that relates to the inevitabilities. He's invoking that again, thinking about how, if you're going to have any measure of nearness to divinity, there is also remoteness from divinity. The two go hand in hand. And all the different ways that plays together. It's here again. He's bringing that in again. He's trying to turn our thinking around so that we can see that as a potential rather than as a hindrance. If there weren't stop moments, there would be nothing for you. So, learn to appreciate that there's stop moments, that there's defect interruptions. That's the only, it's only because of the defect interruptions that you have any relationship to anything that comes from the Father. So it's just, it's trying to turn our all of our thinking 180 degrees around. All right?
Okay.
And nature is marred, her beautiful face is scarred, her features are seared by the rebellion, the misconduct, the misthinking of the myriads of creatures who are a part of nature, but who have contributed to her disfigurement in time. No, nature is not God. Nature is not an object of worship.
Okay. So now just holding that, see, you put the point on it, and then let's move into the next section.
I also had a realization that it's important also to just let the film keep rolling. That many people, including me sometimes, try to jam it up.
Sure.
Like, stop here. No more. Right. And there's a wonderful freedom in realizing it's not my job to stop the movie. I have to just let it go.
Yeah, and that's the courage to strike step with the actual reality, which is dynamic. Our fear wants to stop it. Our godlikeness delights in its motion. All right, so now...
Just out of curiosity, what's interesting as well in this last sentence, mm-hmm. they bring up the notion of Marantia Moda. Without any definition, the author is
mm-hmm. yeah.
bringing up Marantia Moda and then talking about it redefined or revelation and its compensatory adjustment without really any explanation of what Marantia Moda is.
Yeah, good point. And there's you see that often in these first five papers. That's a very, very sort of definitive one. It is just there's no seems doesn't seem to be any context at all, like I've mentioned a few times, God the Father is the initiator, and the first five papers on God the Father initiate the main threads throughout the book. It's a revelation of the truth of the nature of the Father. So the book is constructed to synchronize with that truth, that primal truth of the Father as the initiator. They're in just just abrupt fashion, they're initiating the word moda there. They want you to follow that, see where that goes. For those of us who, have read the religion papers, you just take that sentence in stride. But yeah, Andre makes a good point. Notice, imagine if you're a brand new reader, and it's like, what are they talking about here? Just dropped out of the blue.
Yep.
Okay.
I don't quite see how it could be marred, beautiful face scarred, seared by the rebellion. I mean, what does the rebellion have to do with nature?
Well, remember, we're talking a lot more than just rocks here. No, that's what I'm saying. We're talking a lot more than just rocks.
Biology,
genetics. We're talking about all of nature.
We're part of nature.
Oh. Right? We're not just talking matter. There's a difference between materialism and naturalism. Naturalism is just taking, all of nature, living, not living, everything, and letting that just be an a priori given. It's a little bit stronger to say that it's absolutely nothing but matter, and go that materialism. So, we have naturalism in play here. And just taking nature for granted, all of nature. Like I was saying, it's very easy to understand how mankind as part of nature has been, affected by the rebellion. But like John was pointing out at the beginning there, who knows how what ramification that has on the whole system. Because this is all one system, and that's a good point to actually have in mind as we move in here to the next, to this first paragraph in the next section. There's been a strong, aggressive movement in modern times to disconnect man from nature. And once disconnected, then to lessen men. To the point of many, proudly declaring that man is a virus in the divine nature. Okay? A malignant virus. That can do nothing but mar, scar, and sear. If it weren't for man, there would be no marring, scarring, or searing. Last time I checked, Lucifer wasn't a man. One thought to just put in there. But here, let's take this first paragraph.
Paper 4, Section 3, God's Unchanging Character. All too long has man thought of God as one like himself. God is not, never was, and never will be jealous of man or any other being in the universe of universes. Knowing that the Creator Son intended man to be the masterpiece of the planetary creation, to be the ruler of all the earth, the sight of his being dominated by his own baser passions, the spectacle of his bowing down before idols of wood, stone, gold, and selfish ambition, these sordid scenes stir God and his sons to be jealous for man, but never of him.
Okay, so notice how it starts. All too long has man thought of God as one like himself. Remember how that little paragraph with stupid in it started out. It is a great blunder to humanize God. That was how that statement began. Okay, so we're coming back to that. Now let's deal with the Old Testament, woven through this first. For those who are familiar with any sort of standard Christian context, if I say the Lord is a jealous God, that sentence, I've heard that sentence. That's Old Testament stuff. I remember that. You know, so obviously they're directly addressing that. But not just, you know, appreciate if you don't already the etymology, if you will. I mean, the origin of the word jealous. I mean, the word jealous is just a slight modification of the word zealous. It's really the same word. You're just, you know, you're allowing both the word zealous and jealous, you know, which are really the same word, to be in existence, and then creating a differentiation, you know, where they, you know, have slightly different connotations. But when you turn it around like this, I mean, stir God and his sons to be jealous for man. I mean, just replace the word jealous by zealous. You know, they are zealous for man. I mean, we obviously need a lot of help here. Okay? You know, if we're, you know, worshiping a block of wood. If that's the best we can come up with. So zealous for man, never jealous of him. You know, it allows you to see how we've teased those two words apart. Same word, two different spellings. So that's one thing. But notice the currently insanely politically incorrect statement in the middle of that paragraph. Knowing that the Creator's Son intended man to be the masterpiece of planetary creation, to be the ruler of all the earth. Okay. Again, if you know the Old Testament, you know that sort of stuff is in there. And we sophisticated modern people have recognized how silly that thought is. As a matter of fact, we now know that man is a virus, a cancer on the earth. And the last thing you'd ever want to do in school is say God, teach about how God is the first source and center of all things and beings. We now know that nature is the first source and center of all things and beings. And proudly we preach this gospel of nature is the one.
Who is doing all of this?
Well-intentioned, spiritually conscious individuals.
Every college in the country.
I mean, go to at grade schools all over the country. Big posters, you know, where, you know, you've got nature, and you should look to, you know, and basically worship nature, regret the past, whine over the present, and vainly hope for the future of the debauchery of man. That's why there's an exclamation point in the previous section. We've got a sophistry that's been invoked. We're not just talking about people who worship trees here. Okay, primitive, worshiping idols of wood, stone, gold. Okay, that's one thing. Okay, or worshiping trees or rocks or mountains or stars or whatever. Okay, we're talking about this subtle sophistry that can only come into play when there's enough spiritual consciousness in mankind. Primitives didn't have enough spiritual consciousness for this to be an issue, for there to need to be a revelation that has exclamation point sentences in it. You know, where the revelators say, danger. This is what they're talking about. They're talking about this subtle, the moment that you allow secularism to just do that first step of tempering ecclesiasticalism, once it accomplished that and we didn't turn it off, we all know how, the secular totalitarian section, what happens here. You go from separating church and state to separating God and man so that you can throw God out. I mean, you can't throw God out until you separate God from man. So there's militant secularists are working to separate God and man so that God can be disposed of. And in his place, you've got two things. you know, taking the place of God. Man himself, you know, secularism is followed by humanism. Right? And then they're reminding you the other thing that happens. God is replaced by the exaltation of nature. And it's everywhere. I mean, all you have to do is to start opening your ears. You can't go 10 minutes without hearing someone who is unwittingly fallen into this trap. Only spiritually conscious individuals can fall into this trap. If you don't have very much spiritual consciousness, you can't fall into this trap. This is a sophistry. It's, you know, you have, you know, a hollow fact encased in spirit candy. You know, if you don't have any spiritual consciousness, spirit candy doesn't make you salivate. Yeah. You know, we've brought this up many times. This is you know, one of the most ubiquitous themes in the entire fifth epical revelation. This challenge of recognizing that now that spiritual consciousness has been awakened in mankind for many reasons, you know, not the least of which is Michael coming 2,000 years ago as a spiritual uplifter. Now that it's in play, now that spiritual energy is really in play in mankind like it never was before, you must begin to harmonize it with its anchor. You can't reject an anchor to your spiritual consciousness, or there's nothing but danger in play. And the dangers always begin innocently. They begin with sophistries. They begin with the best of intentions, combined with ignorance, combined with a lack of insight, the insight to see through the spiritual candy to the hollow within, you know, the whited sepulcher filled with dead man's bones. You can't, your mere spiritual consciousness can't see inside. You can't see the dead man's bones. All it sees is the whiting, you know, the whitewash on the outside. You know, and it falls in love with it and will follow it wherever it goes. You know, well, it only goes one place. It goes off the cliff. You know, you don't want to follow that. You don't want to be a spiritual lemming in the same way that actual lemmings are, you know, material lemmings. You have to take delight in cultivating ability to recognize, the ability to discriminate between that which is only white on the outside and that which is white all the way through. What's a sophistry and what's real? So then to go back and rediscover those statements in the Bible that have been so deprecated. You don't want to just wonder if, you want to know, and know that the Creator Son intended that we be the ruler of all the earth. That's the responsibility. We are to be the rulers of the earth. If there's going to be any truth, beauty, or goodness to that rulership, we need to be God-conscious citizens. The answer is to the lack of God-conscious citizens and the poorness of mankind's rule is not to back off. It's to go forward. Effort, struggle, conflict, faith, determination, love, loyalty, and progress. You need to go through that. You need to discover, an integrity within that will allow you to be what the Creator Son intended you to be, one of the rulers of the earth. Something that can express the divinity of the Creator Son in downstep form on earth, as opposed to being nothing but something that mars, scars, or sears. Animal origin, you know, is going to mar, scar, and sear. but not God-likeness. The extent to which the history of mankind is nothing but marring, scarring, and searing is the extent to which it's sad to record. It's not because somehow God screwed up, you know. It's because we haven't taken on the challenge. He's given us everything that we need. It's just sad to record that no one is challenging themselves to be more than an animal origin being. Wanted to really stress that. He's directly taking on what has, you know, since the time he wrote this, had decades to blossom. And it's in full bloom now in mankind, the rejection of any notion, you know, that seems like simplistic biblical, you know, thinking, you know, sort of the, you know, that whole reworking of history that, you know, we know that the Jews did and, you know, when they were in captivity, you know, and that turned it all into this Jew-centered chosen people thing, you know, and we throw all that stuff into that and then discard it. It's like, oh, yeah, that's just a bunch of self-aggrandizement. No, you should know that the Creator's Son intended you to be the masterpiece of the planetary creation. And when you look in the mirror, if you don't see the masterpiece of the planetary creation, that's not God's fault. That's your fault. You haven't taken delight in cultivating. Yeah. God is waiting. So, again, see how they love, the revelators love to find something that's really going to push your button and challenge you to turn it 180 degrees around. There are many things that a thread of truth flows through, and we've thrown a baby out with the bathwater. Yeah, and this is a great example.
Chris, Jesus said, greater is he that has self-control than he who takes a city or nation.
Yeah.
Can there be some...
Yeah. Be more than a mere self. Be a self that's been mastered, been made into a masterpiece. See? Yeah. Masterpieces are selves that have been mastered. Personal responsibility and self-control. It's the only reason why there aren't masterpieces walking around. The potential for masterpieces is there, perfectly. But it's sad to record that no one tries. I'm only human. No, you're only animal. Okay? Let's try to be human. All right.
The eternal God is incapable of wrath and anger in the sense of these human emotions and as man understands such reactions. These sentiments are mean and despicable. They are hardly worthy of being called human, much less divine. And such attitudes are utterly foreign to the perfect nature and gracious character of the Universal Father.
Do you notice how I just said that, see? Yeah. They are hardly worthy of being called human. Stop. You know, so in other words, stop it. Stop saying, I'm only human when I'm wrathful and angry. No, those aren't human words. Animals do that. All animals basically do the anger thing. That's really basal. Like I said, base and, you know, mean and despicable. Base and, you know, and only to be looked down upon. And wrath, okay, that's just, you know, turning, lifting anger up into fancy animal land. Okay? So you can be an animal or a fancy animal, but it's hardly worthy of being called human.
But wasn't there something akin to anger, or maybe you'd call it a sense of injustice, when Jesus was perturbed?
What's the word? What's the word that distinguishes that from anger? There's a word that's been coined to distinguish that. Indignation. Righteous indignation. That's one thing. That's something that's coming down. It's righteous indignation. It's a state of mind that's a consequence of a recognition of righteousness. It's not something that's welling up from below. It's not exalted anger.
And of the indignity of something. Indignation.
Right. Indignation. Right.
We have this discussion on Facebook today, and people are saying that God was actually experiencing anger, because when you look in the dictionary, anger or indignation says it's angry.
How many sentences in the Urantia book does it take to refute that thought? There's one sentence. We just read it. The eternal God is incapable of wrath and anger. So any rationalization scheme that you come up with, which might be airtight and explain everything you can think of, that starts with the assumption that God was angry, that rationalization scheme is false. Doesn't matter if it gets the right answers to everything, quote unquote. It's a false rationalization. It starts with a false premise. I mean, there's the entire B section of the Library of Congress is filled with books and books of rationalization schemes like that. Okay, they're wholly false. It's not that he seldom is wrathful or angry. He's incapable of wrath and anger. Period. God doesn't love. God is love.
Moses even taught the God was that way.
Sure. Yeah. So just ask yourself a simple question. Am I so primitive that I'm only capable of what Moses was able to teach?
He was also worshiping
Cana. Or am I something more than that? If the answer is no, I'm just so primitive, that's all I can do. Well, God still loves you absolutely. Okay, but, recognize your limitation there.
Yeah, but the whole Bible is full of that. So there's millions and millions.
When was the Bible written? Was it written yesterday? No, it was written a long time ago.
Believe that. Yeah. That God is an angry God and he's a wrathful God. It says that right there.
Yeah, and we all know it's not just, about these two things that uses words like travesty and stupid. There's other spots in the book that point out these other things that we've carried forward from primitive consciousness and uses just as harsh of words to describe the act of continuing to think like that. You would continue to think like that because you see yourself as primitive? Why are you doing that? Well, I guess I never thought about it. But now that you make me think about it, you're right, that is pretty primitive. Why the heck am I doing that? What on earth was I thinking? Right, because no one thinks. No one reflects about it. It's sad to record that so few persons reflect. All it takes is 1 second of reflection to see how silly those thoughts are. It's like, what on earth was I thinking? Oh, that's right, I wasn't. I had my brain turned off. Let me turn my brain on.
They even say deep thinking and clear reasoning is the key to self-evidence.
Yes, but it's sad to record. They don't mince words when it comes to these points. They just hit you full on. Just like when Jesus, when one of the apostles took Jesus aside, or even sometimes when they were all in a group, Jesus would say something. It's like, whoa, wow, that's like harsh. Aren't you just going to break all those little faint flickers of faith saying that, Jesus? That's just like way over the top. Okay. He knew how much he'd built up in him and how hard he could hit him. And he hit him as hard as he could, right to the point of breaking. Because that's what God does. God built a universe that puts you to the test. And it hits you as hard as you can take. And if you can take more, it hits you harder. That's called an evolutionary universe. We talked about this a while back. We know that we're agendonters. That means in order for you to get to eternity, you have to actualize something in you that's not just mere steel. You have to actualize agendonter steel. steel that can withstand blows that normal ascender steel can't withstand. You've been given the challenge to become an ascender who can withstand the greatest blows. There's no easy path for us. To him of much is given, as much expected. It's like, well, I always thought of that as a positive thing. Yeah, but it's also, you're expected to be able to withstand these blows. And if you can't yet, why not? You've been given everything to withstand them. Why can't you? God is going, come on. You know, what more do you want? I even gave you universal fragments of infinity. How much more potential strength do you want? You know? Yeah, but, you know, the cushion is kind of hard, God. You know? It should be nicer if it was softer. Can't you make the cushion softer? What if I pray fervently for soft cushions? we're just so mixed up on this. You know, that's not what it's about. It's about taking up the challenge to be God's steel. All right.
Very much of the difficulty which your rancho mortals have in understanding God is due to the far-reaching consequences of the Lucifer Rebellion and the Caligastia Betrayal. On worlds not segregated by sin, the evolutionary races are able to formulate far better ideas of the Universal Father. They suffer less from confusion, distortion, and perversion of concept.
You know, again, because of the hierarchy of fathers. You're supposed to have those downstep expressions of the Father right in front of you. So it's much easier to form, you know, a correct notion about the extension of that Father likeness up to the infinite level. And we don't have those. You know, a lot of times we don't even have our biologic Father with any integrity in front of us, let alone, you know, the Father of the realm, Adam, you know, or the Father, you know, of the system. Being expressed through a planetary prince. And notice again, we got three words in sequence there. You know, confusion, distortion, perversion. That's error, evil, sin. Remember I pointed out how that, you know, that, you have that spot where they do self-confusing, self-disrupting, self-destroying, you know, and then they even add iniquity, self-destruction. Again, confusion. In other words, you've got it all poured together. Okay, that's unwise. That's error. Distortion, you know, literally means very twisted. Not just a mind that's got a little bit of twisting oscillation going on. You know, your spirit is grabbing hold of the mind and twisting it. Okay, evil. And then perversion, remember that means, you know, that's versus, you know, the root there, turn. And the P-E-R prefix means it's not just turned a little bit, it's turned 180 degrees. It's turned all the way around. You know, that's sin. When, you know, instead of God being the center, you turn it all the way around, self is the center. That's sin. Okay, so there it is again. Confusion, distortion, perversion, error, evil, sin. Yep.
God repents of nothing he has ever done, now does, or ever will do. He is all-wise as well as all-powerful. Man's wisdom grows out of the trials and errors of human experience. God's wisdom consists in the unqualified perfection of his infinite universe insight, and this divine foreknowledge effectively directs the creative free will.
Just real quick, I mean, again, not only do we have the Lord as a jealous God, but we've got, you know, in the Old Testament, God repenting. You know, again, it's we're challenging that, if that isn't obvious.
yeah. The Universal Father never does anything that causes subsequent sorrow or regret. But the will creatures of the planning and making of his creator personalities in the outlying universes by their unfortunate choosing, sometimes occasion emotions of divine sorrow in the personalities of their creator parents. But though the father neither makes mistakes, harbors regrets, nor experiences sorrows, he is a being with a father's affection, and his heart is undoubtedly grieved when his children fail to attain the spiritual levels they are capable of reaching with the assistance which has been so freely provided by the spiritual attainment plans and the mortal ascension policies of the universes. See, so he can't be angry or wrathful, but he can grieve.
Right. See, that's why I was speaking passionately about this, you know. I mean, he does, you know, undoubtedly grieve in his heart when you just refuse to use the gifts that he's given you. You know, it's sad to record to God. It's sad that his children will not. You know, there's none so blind as those who will not see. That's the problem on the planet. You know, people refuse to use the gifts that God has given us that would give us the strength and the, you know, the wisdom, the insight, and the foresight to deal with our difficulties. You know, again, you know, just let it be full on. Is that what you want to do? Do you want to make the Father grieve? Is that what you want emblazoned on your tombstone? Here lies one who made her father grieve. I mean, if you know, pigheadedness, belligerency. I mean, you know, it may make you feel good. Maybe, it's like, well, I'm not going to, okay? Yeah. And, you know, I'm not going to let anyone, you know, I'm not going to give up anything for anyone. You know, it's all about me, you know, okay? You know, it's not all about you. The Father lives within you. Every time you think like an animal like that, when you put yourself first, you say, well, you know, I'm not going to give anything to my partner. My partner can, you know, just take a hike. Either my partner conforms to me or my partner can get lost. Okay, that makes the Father grieve. And he's trying to be poignant here. He's trying to get you, he's trying to appeal to your spiritual consciousness to cut through the crap, you know, of our animal minds. You know, why on earth would you think like that? Yeah.
The infinite goodness of the Father is beyond the comprehension of the finite mind of time. Hence must there always be afforded a contrast with comparative evil, not sin, for the effective exhibition of all phases of relative goodness. Perfection of divine goodness can be discerned by mortal imperfection of insight only because it stands in contrastive association with relative imperfection in the relationships of time and matter in the motions of space. The character of God is infinitely superhuman. Therefore, must such a nature of divinity be personalized as in the divine sons before it can even be faith grasped by the finite mind of man.
Okay, so again, that second to last paragraph, you see, we're invoking the inevitability contrast again. You know, he's obviously, ever since he introduced him, he's looking for endless opportunities to reinforce that reflection, to see how the two go hand in hand. That statement, perfection of divine goodness can be discovered by mortal imperfection of insight only because it stands in contrastive association with relative imperfection. So just, you know, even think about that. Those three reality responses, those three cosmic insights that you have through the Holy Spirit, you know, those aren't absolute insights. They're relative insights. They're objective, but not absolute. And how does that work? You know, just to get, you know, that he's trying to get, you know, reflect on that. That, you know, the only way that those insights can be objective, even though they're not absolute, is because of the contrast. The contrast is what powers the objective discernment in the absence of absoluteness. There's some physics of how reality works that he's trying to get you to think about here. Very subtle stuff. That last statement there, the character of God is infinitely superhuman. Had us reflect on this a little bit previously, and just appreciate what that means. There's no way you're going to have any relationship to that unless something can bring it to a focus. Something that's infinitely superhuman, I mean, how are you possibly going to wrap your mind around that? That somehow has to be brought to a focus. That's the power of personality. Notice the way they construct that sentence. I mean, it's easy to think that it's sort of all about the divine sons, but, you know, notice there's a comma in there. It starts out, therefore must a nature of divinity be personalized. Personality is a focusing mechanism. And yeah, I mean, a real, real downstep example of that focus is there in the Divine Sons. But it's not just that. The only reason that you can have any relationship with God the Father is because of that facet that's called the Universal Father, that self-personalized deity, that aspect of God the Father that brings that infinite God the Father to a focus. And the only reason that even that works is because God gave you a focus recognizing attribute, personality. Because you have the eyes of a person, or potentially if you've taken delight in cultivating the eyes of a person, the eyes of a person can see the focus that personality manifests. You know, so it's a subtle focus. It's not a focus that animal eyes can see. It doesn't literally take matter and squish it into a tiny little blob so that you can stick it in front of you and see it. It doesn't take infinity and make it, yeah, down to a literal point like that. But in this subtle transcendent way, it projects that infinity into a focused point that you can see because you're a person. Before it can even be faith grasped by the finite mind of man. And of course, you have a faith grasp because of that personality. Like I said, the only reason that you can see that and grasp it is because you have a like mechanism, a like focusing mechanism. But it's not automatic. That personality is just a potential. You have to choose to actualize it. How do you actualize that? Effort, struggle, conflict. You have to take something to conflict. And then you have to reach up with your faith grasp, you know, and overcome that conflict. That's how you actualize that personality potential. It's impossible to actualize personality potential except through conflict. That's, again, quite, you know, at odds with a lot of historical thinking about this. That's why I always repeat that. Effort, struggle, conflict, faith, determination, love, loyalty, and then and only then progress. Progress, you know, is you are more personal. You have a more personal self than when you started. You know, that mirror self has been converted in, or at least a measure of that mirror self has been converted into a personal self. Now you need to take the next measure of mirror self, take it through conflict and through faith, and transform it into personal self. And then the next measure, and the next measure. You do that a few times, and you've gone from seventh circular to sixth circular. You do that some more, and you've gone from sixth circular to fifth circular. You do it some more. That's the road, you know. There is no way up the cosmic levels except through conflict and faith, you know, invocation of faith within yourself.
Where in the book are those?
It's in the True Religion section up in the Jesus Papers. Is anyone?
1729.
Okay. And just to reflect on it, and again, see, it's like, wow, that sounds like work. Yeah. Again, it's about Angandantar steel, you know. So conflict for us is a lot more severe than conflict for others. It's like, well, that's not fair. Why couldn't I have been on one of those planets where, you know, all they had to do was overcome small conflicts?
Who are they going to call?
You know, there will come a day when those who have Angandantar steel will be indispensable to some circumstance. Only you will be able to stand unmoved. You know, what if, you know, a million years from now, you're on a planet and things are going a little wishy-washy in the leaders, and someone needs to stand unmoved. You know, will you be Van or will you be Nod? You know? Will you be Amadon-like? Van was Amadon-like. And Amadon was Van-like. They stood unmoved. They had the fibers of strength woven into their being. They did not break. Nod had not taken adequate delight in cultivating spiritual fibers within. He made it all the way up through all the Mansion worlds, our Mansion worlds, all the way on to Gerasim. Still breakable. He hadn't fused yet. So now you shine the light on him and you find that the only reason he looked like he was solid because there was an adjuster in him. You took the adjuster out, put him on this planet. That boy was a whited sepulcher. You know, you took the adjuster out and he was hollow inside. That's the only thing that was filling it. There wasn't any of him inside. It was just this fancy spirit candy, you know. You know, it was pretty fancy candy. It could make secondary or primary midwayers, and, you know, it was groovy stuff. But it was hollow inside. You know, so you hit it and it just shattered. Yeah, but Van was solid. And even lowly Amadon was solid.
It's kind of nice when you have some kind of a conflict and then you're able to overcome it and then you're able to stand firm and unmoved in your faith. You feel a little bit stronger.
Yeah. It might even be delightful.
Yeah, and how you immediately are reminded of the difference between joy and happiness. You know, joy is a spiritual experience, but happiness only results from choice. This choice. You know, if you overcome conflict through faith, on the other side lies something called happiness, vastly transcendent of mere joy. Joy that, you know, the moment things get tough, it evaporates, slips through your fingers. You know, choices can't slip through your fingers. You know, real choice is a grasp of eternity. Eternity's not going anywhere. Okay? You know, happiness endures. A state of happiness is a state that could have something amazing, like enduring peace instead of fleeting peace. Joy and fleeting peace go together. Enduring peace and happiness, okay, come from choice, to choose. You know, God has given you the ability to choose eternity, to eternalize part of your nature, make it immutable, unassailable.
Chris, joy is the outcome. Happiness is in the moment, but I could be wrong. No, maybe in a spiritual sense, it's the other way around.
What the Revelators are trying to challenge those words into this more definitive mode. Well,
I know worship is the greatest joy in paradise.
It's not like you should avoid joy. If you're spiritual, you're going to experience joy, but you want joy plus happiness, not just joy. And as a matter of fact, what you actually want is you want the kind of joy that results from happiness, not joy that hasn't gotten to happiness yet. Thank you. See? That's what they're trying to get us to see. Happy are they? How's that different than joyful are they? What's the contrast?
Happy are they who?
Thank you.
What's the rest of that?
Well, it's all of them. It's every one of them. So just reflect on that. You get into a discussion like this, and then let your mind weave what you've just studied into the rest of the framework, like we're kind of doing here, letting it really become woven in and augment the nature of identification to the cosmos that you have within you. Really see how it fits in, and now that synchronization to the cosmos has a whole new wing to it that it didn't have before. You found a way to really get I now really understand that effort, struggle, conflict. For instance, or one of these things. Always be seeking for a way to lock that in place. So it's like, okay, that's crystal clear now. I understand how that fits. And that isn't just a sequence of words that I have to try to memorize and are platitude-like. Mankind doesn't need more platitudes, and any of us don't need more platitudes in our head. Platitudes break. Yeah. All right, so next time we'll go on to the realization and the erroneous ideas here of God, and you'll see that it's pretty fun how this next one starts out. They're going to take us a long ways from those wooden idols that they mentioned in passing, or he, I suppose, is the divine counselor that's writing this, and he's going to take us to a place that we're able to recognize now. You're going to start reading that first paragraph and go, wait a minute, I've seen those adjectives before. I know what's going on there. So we'll get into that next time. Let's take a moment here.